The following is a special presentation of Catholic Radio in South Carolina, recorded in the Catholic booth at the South Carolina State Fair in Columbia. We now present Catholic Radio at the Fair, a series of interviews with apostolates and Catholic program directors from the Midlands and elsewhere in the diocese.
We are back at the State Fair here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. I'm Jim Corbett, along with Robert Keeter, who is a member of St. Peter's in Columbia, South Carolina, who is actively involved in the St. Vincent de Paul Society at St. Peter's, and has been involved in one project of note that has grown and grown and grown and become a signature event for Catholics, not only in the Midlands of South Carolina, but the entire state. It is a Thanksgiving Day dinner put on by St. Peter's Church and First Baptist Church. And when I say St. Peter's, I know people from my parish of St. Joseph and other Catholic parishes also help out. And I'm sure that some other people from who aren't going to St. Peter's or First Baptist go. But those are the two main churches which put together basically a free meal catering toward the homeless. And Robert, it is one of the things that catches people's eye and their imagination and says, there is faith in action.
Well, our action is getting things done when we're asked to be active in some sort of ministry. And ours happened to be the homeless, the poorest of the poor of our community, to be invited into their lives and they in ours. And we do that in multiple ways. Obviously, the climax, as I like to call it, is the big Thanksgiving, interfaith Thanksgiving dinner at the Coliseum with the Baptists. But it's a ministry throughout the year. We do lots of other things, visit nursing homes once a month and celebrate birthdays, and we play bingo. And then we have calls coming in every day for utility help, and, of course, we are responding to that. And then we have the third Saturday meals every third Saturday that are sponsored by not only our churches but a lot of other churches like Baptist churches and Lutheran churches. And so it's a community effort. It's just not a Catholic community effort. It's a community effort, and I like to stress that.
So we're talking about a community effort to help feed the homeless. We're talking about something that grew out of the St. Vincent de Paul Society, which is in basically every parish in the state, maybe in the world. And it's a giving to the poor. How is it that this idea came about from St. Vincent de Paul instead of just helping this group out or that group or this family? What made somebody go to First Baptist or vice versa and say, hey, let's put on a big dinner?
Well, as the story goes, and I was there when it happened, so it's a true story, Monsignor Lahaki was given the responsibility by the bishop at the time to spread ecumenism within the Midlands community. And one of the things he wanted to look into was expanding our ministry here at St. Peter's, which was St. Vincent de Paul, and how we could expand that with another church or churches. And, of course, he knew Wendell Estep, Dr. Estep, and they just chatted one day on the phone, and then they set up a meeting, and I was invited. And I just happened to be the president of the association at the time. Other than that, I probably wouldn't have gone. But Monsignor called me and asked me if I'd go over to have lunch with Dr. Estep and Steve Phillips, who's the musical director. And we sat down, had lunch, and had a great meeting. And out of that came our first dinner in 1990 on the street, Marion Street, downtown Columbia. We brought our choirs, we brought our tables and chairs, they brought their choirs, and they brought their tables and chairs. And that was our first meal, actually downtown on Marion Street. We fed 362 people. And then from that it grew from there to the Coliseum. We contacted Dr. Palms, who was the president of the university at the time, and asked him, is anybody using the Coliseum on Thanksgiving Day? He said, no. He said, what do you have in mind? I said, we want to have a banquet for those in need in the community of Columbia. Do you want to be part of this ministry? And he said, when, where, how? He gave me a gentleman's name, Sid Kenyon, and from there, it's 20 years later.
Now, Dr. Palms is a faithful Catholic who went to St. Thomas More and St. Joseph's and St. Peter's and every place else where there are other Catholic churches in Columbia. And the Coliseum, for people who know, is the old Carolina Coliseum built in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And you have how many people come there now just to eat?
I would say it varies. It's grown from 360 all the way up to now the highest number I think we've ever fed was like 1,400. So it ranges on an average now between 12 and 1,400. And then 6 years ago, the Baptists and us sat down like we're going to do Monday night, this coming Monday, 25th of October, to discuss the 20th year anniversary of our effort we decided 6 years ago to reach out in the community and bring meals to folks that couldn't come to the counseling, because there's a lot of elderly, there's a lot of people that are handicapped, there are a lot of people that are in such a situation where they can't come to us, so we thought we'd bring our meal to them. So now we carry in the morning out of the Coliseum, we have a group of people come there, and we pack turkey dinners and tons of homemade desserts provided by both churches. We load them up in vans, and we take them to these various assisted living and nursing homes and other shelters by the box loads. So that was something we started 6 years ago, and last year we fed 792 seniors and elderly and handicapped people in the surrounding areas of Columbia. So roughly 2,500 people were fed from this ministry on Thanksgiving Day.
How did you decide with Dr. Estep to pick Thanksgiving and pick a meal?
Well, we were already doing it at St. Peter's. We had already had ongoing a meal in Old Murphy Hall at St. Peter's, St. Vincent de Paul.
The unrenovated Old Murphy Hall.
They had demolished, and now the new Parish Life Center, praise the Lord for that. But we outgrew it, and they demolished it. But anyway, it was a small hall down there called Murphy Hall after Monsignor Murphy, and that's what we fed. We've been feeding down there since about 1980. So we were already there together as Vincentians and as parishioners feeding the homeless on Thanksgiving Day. So that's where Monsignor said, well, maybe we ought to expand that. Maybe let's talk to Dr. Estep about, let's expand the Thanksgiving Day. That is a day to be thankful. And let the two churches come together and try to make an effort to expand this one meal into this banquet as we have it here in Columbia now.
Talk about how the relationship between the two churches, St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church and First Baptist, the Baptist Church in Columbia, has grown over the years because of this event.
Well, I think the relationship is, I think that they have a better understanding about who we are as Christians, and I think we have a better understanding of who they are as Christians. And only because of what brought us together, which is a calling from the Lord to provide something to someone who wouldn't have it otherwise. And that's the common denominator in all religions, whether it's Baptist, Lutheran, Catholic, Jewish. I mean, we are called to serve, and I think whether you're a Baptist or a Catholic, I think we do know what serving means. So they're great people that have great hearts, big hearts. They're very compassionate people, and everything that we do together in these meetings coming up here to discuss this 20th anniversary, it'll be a very collaborative effort. And we don't get into theology, although I do have, I spar once in a while with my cohort, Mr. Ron Paul with First Baptist, about some issues. But we both admire each other because of our commitment to make this effort every Thanksgiving the biggest event in the state of South Carolina. I do try to stress that in my talks that I give around the community, that the biggest thing that's going on in Columbia right now on Thanksgiving Day is not a football game or a basketball game or Kenny Chesney concert. It's going to be everybody coming to the Coliseum and be served a banquet.
And it's done in a spiritual, ecumenical atmosphere. No preaching, though? No talking?
Well, there's an opening prayer by Monsignor, Dr. Estep. They alternate back and forth. And we do have a couple other people that come there with their Bibles. And they'll walk around the Coliseum. And they'll sit down. They'll talk one-on-one. We as Christians are called to do that. We have to be careful about not just pushing it on our guests, but we casually sit down and talk to people, how they're feeling, what's going on in their lives, and hopefully that will make a difference to them, at least for that day, but hopefully will touch their hearts forever.
We're talking with Robert Keeter of St. Peter's Church about the big Thanksgiving feeding, the dinner given to the poor, the homeless, by St. Peter's and First Baptist Church of Columbia. Back with more to talk about with him on that and also his unique perspectives and background in coming to this event after this.
Knights of Columbus Council 704 will hold their 33rd annual 5K Turkey Day Run and Gobble Wobble in downtown Charleston on Thursday, November 25th, beginning at 9 a.m. In addition to the 5K run, there will be a costume contest, children's fun run, live music, and more. For information about this event, the website is www.turkeydayrun.com. That's turkeydayrun.com.
We are back at the State Fair. I'm Jim Corbett here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina with Robert Keeter, who is from St. Peter's Church in Columbia and has been putting on with his parish and with First Baptist Church of Columbia the Thanksgiving Day dinner for the homeless, which is every year at the Carolina Coliseum. And Robert, you have an interesting ecumenical background. Understand that you spent some time at Boys Town, which is the home started by Father Flanagan in Omaha, Nebraska, which I had the pleasure of visiting with my two sons this past June. And one of the things we saw in the museum was that Father Flanagan insisted that the boys, and later on, I guess the girls, would pray, but they would do so in the faith tradition that they were raised in. And that, I guess, might have opened up things to you so that when you came upon this, it was a natural thing for you to do to work with the Baptists and the other denominations, which help out on the Thanksgiving Day dinner.
Yeah, because Boys Town is a home for young men and now women, as you made reference to in 1992. They allowed the young ladies to come on campus and be students also. But yeah, every denomination, every color, every race, every creed was there at Boys Town, and every temperament. And I mean, you just dealt with so many different issues with these young men coming from 50 states. Our time, my younger brother Dave and I came in the 60s. But it wasn't a difficult adjustment, to be honest with you, because we were already in another orphanage in Michigan, but they couldn't take us beyond our high school years. So when we left Jackson, Michigan, to take that long train ride to Boys Town, they greeted us at the train depot. And it was not a very difficult adjustment at all. And I have nothing but great and fond memories of my time at Boys Town. But, you know, Father Flanagan, you know, he's a wonderful man. I didn't know Father Flanagan. He died in 1948 in Germany of a heart attack. They run him back to Boys Town, buried them there in Dowd Memorial Chapel. But don't know of him, read of him, knew where his heart was in 1917 when he was just a parish priest in downtown Omaha, and he saw some kids kind of roughing it up outside, and he tried to break up a fight, and he got to know the kids, and they got to know him, and next thing you know, he was asking the bishop for a little house downtown. Brought the five little boys there into the first home downtown in Omaha, and then eventually talked to a few business people in the city of Omaha, and bought a tract of land outside of Omaha, and that's where Boys Town was built.
It's surrounded by cornfields, but it's no longer outside of Omaha. It's part of downtown Omaha.
Most definitely, yeah. There was nothing but fields from Omaha to Boys Town when I was there, but it's all built up with office towers and businesses and all that. But if you snuck off the campus, you had a long ways to go before you saw another person. And we, not necessarily myself, but we did sneak off occasionally, you know. Typical young kids back in the 60s, you know, we wanted to have some fun, and we'd sneak off the campus of Boys. But Omaha's a long way off, and so you sort of either had to walk or hitchhike or whatever.
Right. We're talking with Robert Keeter of St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church in Columbia, who, along with First Baptist Church, puts on the annual Thanksgiving Day dinner, which will be having its 20th anniversary this Thanksgiving, Thursday, November 25th. Robert, do you think that you will ever really see the outward sign or the inward change in some of the people that you are ministering to bodily, and maybe they're fostering a better relationship with God because another human being has reached out to them in this way?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised how many folks that we have come to our third Saturday, and of course other meals in between, that want to pray with you, that we give devotionals to, that learn from what we're trying to accomplish and come and do it and be servants themselves. We have a couple of gentlemen, Willie in mind, I have in mind, who rides around Columbia and is in his little wheelchair, who always doesn't want to come to be served. He wants to serve. But I remember little Willie, when he had two legs, now he's only got one leg. Now he comes every third Saturday and serves. We have another gentleman by the name of Bob, I call him Big Bob, who came down there many years ago, homeless and helpless, confused, and now he works at a restaurant in the kitchen, doing very well for himself. But I think by example, we can and we should make an effort to change people's lives, not just inwardly, but outwardly, in terms of them being productive citizens.
You mentioned and touched on the other things you do. Third Saturday of every month, St. Peter's has a meal. Christmas Day and Easter, which is the biggest celebration in the Christian world. And you do something those days also.
Yeah, the big Easter dinner is there at the Angler Hall at St. Peter's. We feed between 600 and 700 on Easter, and then 700 or 800 on Christmas, along with Santa. We have anywhere between 50 to 60 to 70 kids that come in also from shelters. We have gifts for everyone. We have Target cards for the kids. So, yeah, we do it throughout the year, and we also serve the elderly in the nursing homes with bingo and activities like that during their birthdays, celebrating their birthdays. And then we have calls at St. Peter's every day for utility help. I mean, we have a fund that we have that the church gives us and that we raise, and we help probably anywhere between 15 and 20 and 25 a month in utility help.
Two last things, Robert. First off, how can somebody help with what is you're doing and throw out phone numbers and websites. Secondly, how can they organize the same type of thing in their own community, whether it's in St. George or Pickens or Greer or down in Somerville?
I could be available to talk to any church group outside the city of Columbia to start up a ministry such as not just the St. Vincent de Paul Conference, but also an event such as this that's really, really needed, especially, as I like to stress, those days that we mentioned, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter, are very, very, very lonely times for so many people.
So the number here for Robert Keeter is area code
803-796-9802.
You can do some serving, maybe, although I understand there's a big demand to be a server at the Coliseum, but a lot of behind-the-scenes work and some financial contributions and maybe spin off to Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter, too.
We'd welcome that. And if you can't get me at that number we just mentioned, just call St. Peter's Church, and they'll contact me in some way.
A joyous ministry for you and a great one, and one that's very moving to many people, Catholic, non-Christian throughout the Midlands. Thank you very much for being with us, Robert Keeter.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Have a blessed day.
God bless you. This is Catholic Radio in South Carolina. I'm Jim Corbett, and with me is Jackie Kasprowski, who is a principal at Cardinal Newman High School in Columbia, has been since the fall of 2006, is currently in her fifth year, and also serves as the interim co-superintendent of schools here in the Diocese of Charleston. Welcome, Jackie.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jackie, you're one who loves Catholic schools. If someone was to ask you, well, why should my children go to Catholic schools in the first place, what's your basic reply?
Everything in a Catholic school is faith-based. It does not make any difference whether it is in the day-to-day curriculum that the students receive from their teachers, in their extracurricular activities, in their athletics. And that faith base helps those students to develop an opportunity for a really faith-based life as years go on. I can tell you that there is research that has been done that shows that students who do attend Catholic schools and go through Catholic schools up through 12th grade are the basis for the parish families and the support of parishes in years to come.
We're here at the State Fair talking with Jackie Kasprowski about Catholic education. A wide variety of people come to the State Fair. Do you have a wide variety of different types of students who attend Catholic schools?
Oh, my goodness. It's just unbelievable. In our diocese, we actually have 32 Catholic schools. This is across the state of South Carolina. There are 28 parish elementary schools and child development centers in some of them. There are two diocesan-owned high schools, one in Columbia, one in Charleston. And then there are two independent Catholic schools that come under the governance of an independent board, but that are responsible to the diocese in terms of religious education. Among all of those schools, you will find a microcosm of the real world in terms of diversity. And I'm not talking just racial diversity. I am also speaking of learning needs diversity. I am speaking of faith diversity, too, because our schools are open to those who would like to come into them.
What is it that these diverse children are given on a day-to-day basis of the Catholic faith, even if they're not Catholic, that is supposed to help them through their day, through the year, and then through their life?
We, first of all, I believe, give them a very wonderful opportunity to develop their own personal relationship with God, whether that is if they are Catholic or if they are of faiths other than Catholic, the opportunity to come into contact and to commune with God each day is there. I can tell you in my own school, Cardinal Newman, we begin the day with prayer. That prayer is led by members of our student body who are part of our Catholic Commission through campus ministry. Our students pray in each class before that class begins, every single class that happens. Our students are given the opportunity to learn about social justice and about reaching out in the community to be there for others who may need help. They learn that in their Catholic schools. Plus, I will tell you, our faith-based environment also provides a safe place for children to be. And I think that's a very important aspect as well. Each grade level takes religion, whether the children are Catholic or of other faiths. And the religion classes that they take have all been approved by the director of religious education for our diocese, and they are steeped in Catholic tradition. They give any student who is there, Catholic or otherwise, a very strong foundation in how to live a good life in communion with God.
Are there any problems different that are faced by the Catholic schools, especially the high school level with teenagers, than other schools, or is it the same?
Again, perhaps because of the faith base, we are fortunate in terms of problems. I certainly could not sit here, Jim, and tell you that Cardinal Newman or Bishop England or either of the other two high schools does not face some of the same problems that are faced in a Catholic school. But because our atmosphere is really centered on the whole idea of respect for each other, as was taught by Christ himself, we don't have the difficulties in terms of disrespect, in terms of terrible bullying. Those issues, if they do come up, are immediately addressed, and they are addressed within the context of that faith life. It gives us a lot of leeway in dealing with difficulties that do come up. The same thing for social problems that are experienced in the schools besides bullying. With drug and alcohol, I will certainly not say that students in Catholic schools do not use drugs or alcohol. I would be a fool if I said that. I will tell you, during the school day, it does not happen.
And you, in fact, have done searches of locker rooms and lockdowns and all that sort of stuff to keep those things to a minimum.
And that is all part of that safe environment that we work to provide, and we do keep those things to a minimum.
Jackie, thanks so much for your time here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. We've been talking with Jackie Kasprowski, principal of Cardinal Newman High School in Columbia, the interim co-superintendent of schools for the Diocese of Charleston. We appreciate you being here.
My pleasure, Jim. Thank you very much.
Here at the State Fair in Columbia, South Carolina, on Catholic Radio in South Carolina, I'm Jim Corbett, and with us is Cecilia Cunningham, who is a Catholic homeschool mother who has children that are now ranging from the age of 7 to 23, all of which have been and are in the process of being homeschooled. And welcome here, Cecilia.
Thank you, Jim.
And we're glad for you to come and share and talk with us about homeschooling in the Catholic faith. One of the first things people might say is, well, have you ever thought about sending your kids to Catholic schools, and why not?
I think that I am a little bit different from most homeschooling parents in that I first heard about homeschooling from a philosophy professor when I was in college. So at the age of 19, I just decided that's what I'm going to do. So I knew long before I met my husband and before I had kids, that's what I wanted to do.
What are some of the other reasons that you have found out from people in the homeschooler organizations about why they're homeschooling their children, especially the Catholics?
Mm-hmm. I have met parents with special needs kids who the format of a particular program is not working for their child. I have a relative, and I've known others who homeschooled for just, you know, like a year or so because it helped that particular child mature emotionally to catch up with their peers. So a lot of pressure was relieved from them. They had the year to just mature and gain confidence while continuing their education, and then they went right back into school, and they did great. Other reasons, I've met military families. We ourselves have done some moving around. So for families in our situation, homeschool provides a very stable continuum for the kids so that they are not dealing with going to a new school, having to make new friends in a different place every year or every couple of years. So it's been a very stabilizing force for us and military families that we know.
So there are many reasons why people homeschool.
There are many reasons, and every family is different, and homeschooling can really just be tailored to every family's needs.
Tell me about how faith is incorporated into a homeschooling program.
I would say that as parents, we have it easier than others because we are just living it out all day long, whether we're saying prayers in the morning together, evening prayers, going to Mass as we can. We've been to the Pro-Life March in Washington, D.C.
That's a field trip.
That's a field trip, yeah. But it's something that we can just live all the time. And, of course, as you're dealing with kids and teaching them to share and family squabbles that come up, you're just right there all the time to be able to hopefully impart to them, this is the way you need to behave and you need to apologize. And so I think it's easier for us because I am home all the time with them. I'm not getting them at the end of the day. They're tired and I'm tired, and you just want to get them to bed.
The best part of you for the best part of them during the best part of the day.
That's very true, yes.
Now, you have 9 children, so it may seem to make a whole lot of sense with the moving around the community to you to homeschool. What about people who have 1, 2, or 3 children, or they're contemplating having children now and they're thinking about school? What do you say about homeschooling? What are the things they should think about and that the factors they should take into account into whether or not they want to homeschool or not?
Mm-hmm. The church has always taught that parents are the primary educators of their children. And so it's up to us to decide what is the best education methodology for our kids. Some families are intimidated. They feel that there's no way that they can possibly provide an education for their kids. They may not realize the resources that are out there now. You can buy entirely prepackaged curriculums that are, you know, reliably orthodoxly Catholic. So there's all kinds of support out there. There are co-ops with parents who get together where parents will teach particular classes so that if someone is not comfortable, like me, with teaching a biology class, you can always find a way in different communities to sign your kids up to take a biology class, and then it's one less stress on the mom.
What about activities? You miss out on activities when you're homeschooled. How do you deal with that or make up for that or compensate for that?
Mm-hmm. I think that is a very common misconception. It's certainly one of the first questions people ask homeschoolers is, what about the socialization? What about extracurricular activities? And if you ask anyone who is homeschooled for any length of time, if anything, you have to learn not to get involved in too many activities. I have had my kids involved in all kinds of things. They have done reenacting. They have worked at therapeutic riding barns. I have boys, 3 boys currently playing soccer with different leagues. One of the exciting things to me is that there are now homeschooling sport leagues to accommodate situations where homeschoolers may not be given access to join sports with public school teams, for example.
How about things like art and drama and music and the band and all those types of things? How do you find outlets for your children doing those things?
Again, it's not too hard to find. Columbia has a homeschooling band. There are co-ops that do the art and drama. You know, a lot of kids are in dance lessons, taking ballet, being part of things like the Nutcracker every Christmas, Irish step dancing. Any activity that any kids in a structured school program at public or private schools, all those activities are generally available for homeschoolers.
We're talking with Cecilia Cunningham, who is a mother of 9 and a homeschooler, a Catholic homeschooler, here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina, and we're here at the State Fair. Cecilia, we can tell that
By the grace of God.
Yeah, and your love of your children is in your heart, knowing at age 19 you're going to homeschool them all. Did you know you're going to have 9 kids?
No, I did not.
But you wouldn't have changed it, would you?
No, I don't think so.
Good. Thank you so much, Cecilia Cunningham, for being with us, a Catholic homeschooler from here in the Midlands of South Carolina. And we wish you continued success because
your
youngest is only 7, so there are a few more years of homeschooling
ahead. I've still got some years to go.
Great fun to you.
Uh-huh.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are back at the State Fair here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. I am Jim Corbett, joined by Christine Blake, who is a professor at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, and who is here to talk about the women's perspective on a working mom, mother, faithful Catholic with a husband, and how you juggle it all against the world. And a lot of times, Christine, we think about the daily problems we have as a parent, as a working person, as a spouse, and trying to get it all together. And a lot of times we can lose that faith element because we're dealing with schedules and things and responsibilities. How do you balance the career, parental responsibilities of you and your husband, and make sure your kids are being taught the faith while still participating in the world?
Where I'm at now is in part because of decisions that my husband and I made a long time ago in deciding about career and whether we knew we were going to have a family. I expected I'd have a career because we met in school. I was in college, he was in graduate school, and then I ended up going on. I kept going to graduate school, and every decision that we made was always with the intention of eventually having a family. So deciding, well, will this decision in my furthering my education allow me to actually be able to raise a family and not be a waste of time? So in deciding to go into academia, I looked at that closely and talked with a lot of other women who were my mentors and other faculty members and decided, yeah, this is doable, but only as a team. And he also, in the same way, made decisions about his career in that way. So he's a guidance counselor, which means his school schedule matches up with the kids' school schedule. He's out early in terms of, in terms of the day. He's done by 2:30 or anywhere 2:30 to 4:30, depending on his day. And we can flex hours. So before we even got married, we were talking about things like this. How it actually played out, it's been an ongoing learning process, drawing in support, making sure we have the time to devote to each other and the kids and our jobs and still get sleep. Every day we try to do that and remind ourselves the priorities in order.
We talk interviews like this about special things or about particular groups, and here we're talking about the general, trying to help people understand that you can have a family, you can have two careers, and you can have a faith-based family. It just takes some work, and it takes a few little tricks. What is it that you do in your family to try to make sure that you always come back to the basis of the family, which is the faith?
For me personally, it's prayer. I can't get through my day if I don't pray. Over the course of 2 years being here in South Carolina, I've discovered that Mass is offered at 12:30 in the middle of my day. So I can take part of my lunch, I can go to Mass, and then come back to my office. And just to keep myself grounded, keep things in perspective, keep God first, then my family, and then my friends, other people, and then myself, try to keep things balanced and keep my priorities straight, I guess you could say. That's a big thing for me, prayer at home, trying to make sure that we have a regular routine with the kids, that we take them, I take them to daily Mass when I can, if they're with me, or we go, we go every Sunday, have a regular routine. So a lot of it is the logistics and the scheduling that allow us to keep that in our lives, praying in the home with the kids, keeping perspective and not getting overwhelmed by the stupid little stuff.
There's pressure on people of faith all over our world, especially when you get into the more intellectual areas. How do you deal with the attitudes that are prevalent on university campuses, not just in Columbia, but everywhere?
I think in part it's going to depend on the department you're in or the area of the university. I'm in public health. So the field of public health tends to attract people who have, maybe you could say, a higher calling or a different kind of calling where it's a service-oriented profession. Most people I know in public health are there to try and make the world a better place. So conversations about faith and about why we do what we do come into play. Now, that being said, there are a variety of different views and different perspectives on religion, even within my department. So the way I tend to navigate that is, I guess I preemptively end up being around a lot of people who share my views that offer support, but then I engage in dialogue with people who don't share my views and listen to them and then express my point. And we actually have a pretty healthy dialogue with most of the people I encounter. that may not be true in other departments or areas.
Right. So you have if you have the right attitude, people are going to have to accept you no matter what, because you have the right attitude. That way people have to accept, even if they don't want to, the fact that you're a faith-based person.
Yeah, I think my faith is out there. People know that I'm a practicing Catholic. And
it's part of your daily routine.
And it's part of my daily routine. And in fact, that's an interesting thing that comes up, the fact that I go to daily Mass. And I tend to be fairly strict about scheduling appointments at 12:30. And so as a practical matter, that gets in the way sometimes when someone wants a meeting at 12:30. I say, sorry, I go to Mass at that time, but I can meet you at 1, I can meet you at 12, mm-hmm. around that. And most people are okay, but I can tell I get some strange looks. I said to some people I know are Catholic, you can come with me if you want to. People are pretty accepting of it, though, because I'm not using my own time.
We're talking with Christine Blake, who is a assistant professor in the Department of Health at the University of South Carolina, and we're addressing the day-to-day problems and joys of being a family facing the world with two careers, and how you're able to continue to grow and prosper and have your kids grow and prosper in their faith.
But besides the modeling, one of the things we've tried to institute in our house, and it's hit or miss depending on our schedules, but it's family meetings. And not just having the regular family dinner, which we're pretty strict about as well, where we talk and interact with our kids, but having an official family meeting where we sit down and talk about a topic, whatever it might be. My husband and I decide ahead of time. And they're little, so it might only be 5 minutes. And we draw pictures while we do it, so it's like fun. But to get the kids used to talking with us and asking questions and thinking about things and trying to understand different viewpoints, and we try to help guide their thinking in that way. Because one of the big things we really want to teach our kids is, not just obedience. Obedience is important. They need to listen to us and their teachers, but they also need to ask questions and understand why they're being asked to do what they're doing, or why it's important to do one thing versus another thing.
We're at the State Fair here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. I'm Jim Corbett, along with Christine Blake, who graduated from State University of New York at Plattsburgh and then went to Cornell University to get several postgraduate degrees, and has just moved into the state 2 years ago. Christine, if you had a few things of advice, parting advice to parents of children where both parents work in the home, and you're trying to make sure they stay in the straight and narrow without having a repressed lifestyle, what would you tell people to do to make sure their kids have fun but yet learn and understand their faith?
Oh, steer them toward being really good at discernment and holding on to their faith and prayer and not being afraid to be different, to go against the mainstream. I think that's the big thing that we try to teach in our house, that, these other things may be what everybody else is doing, but here's who we are and this is why we're Catholic, and try to teach them that at home. I think the parents need to remember we're the most important teachers of our kids. CCD is important, but that's an add-on to what we do in the home. So we need to treat the home environment as where we run CCD.
Because the home is, in a way, Catholic instruction by example every day.
By example, by our word, by how we live our lives. And even if we have our kids in a public school, having them not, also showing them not to be afraid to say they're Catholic, even if no one else in the room is Catholic. We also go through conversations about how to respond to people who have questions about being Catholic. With my older one more so, he's starting to get kids asking him, well, what kind of church do you go to, or... Mm-hmm. So seeing different things. The kids saw the rosary beads in the house. What are those?
And that's an interview for another day about the rosary.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for your time here, Christine Blake, who is assistant professor at the Department of Health at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, and together with her husband, whose name we haven't mentioned yet.
Patrick Blake.
With Patrick Blake, raising two children, working, both of them, raising them in a Catholic family, and staying true to the faith. Thank you very much for your time. We're here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina at the State Fair in Columbia, talking to Steve Burdick about an encounter, something called Marriage Encounter, which is after it's supposed to be over and it's on its way and it's begun. And how do you describe a marriage? Because you get married and that's a goal, and then you're married and you're supposed to be something, and then other things come up, and maybe all those different thoughts are why Marriage Encounter exists. And you are intimately involved in it. In fact, you run a program, don't you?
My wife and I were a presenting team, couple for over 10 years, and we have been involved since our first weekend in 1981 until present. We've just finished a turn as registration couple You know, introducing the weekend, as we call it, to couples, getting them to sign up, or making those arrangements for them to go on a weekend.
Okay, I'm married. Mm-hmm. Why do I go to Marriage Encounter?
You go to Marriage Encounter because you want your marriage to be the best it could ever be. You want communication that is open, that is honest, that is funded, that is very succinct in dealing with marriage issues. Living in the world is tough. Marriage in the world is very difficult. If you turn on the TV, if you open a magazine, if you look at a radio or a television program, if you just talk to your friends, they all pull you away from a married lifestyle, a married ideal. And Marriage Encounter certainly really supports you in learning and applying skills that will keep your marriage fresh.
How?
It's the key is communication.
Now, I hear that all the time about everything. What makes Marriage Encounter so communicative?
Well, the first time I heard about Marriage Encounter was from a couple that I saw, and they were glowing. They were incandescent. And like moths drawn to the candlelight, we wanted, my wife and I, we wanted what they had. We didn't know how they got it. We didn't know where it came from, but we asked. We said, where did you guys get this? And they said, we made a Marriage Encounter weekend. So we said, how do we sign up? Now, I'll tell you, as a guy, I was reluctant to go. My wife was very emphatic. She said, I think this would be good for us. For the first part of the weekend that I went to, I was sitting there kind of with my knees locked, and I wanted to almost get up and run away, I thought. But as the couples and the team priest began to speak, I just thought, wow, this is great stuff. I can use this. And pretty soon, you know, I was hooked.
What kind of stuff?
Talked about in dealing in our relationship, you know, really where we come from. We start, you know, the weekend starts on a Friday night, and the weekend starts to explore who we are. And it's a very much an individual experience, if you would. Who am I really? Do I present myself to the world as someone other than I really am? So once we discover that, then we start to look at communicating over who are we as a couple? Who are we that make the marriage up? Certainly my wife and I are different people. We have different interests in some senses, and we all communicate differently. We can miscommunicate because we communicate on different levels and in different ways. So Marriage Encounter helps to bring out an awareness of our communication styles. The other thing that brings out, it gives us a framework of communication where we can speak about those issues that we might find personally very painful. Those issues that we say, well, those are my issues, hands off. You know, even though we're married, that's my private space. You can't be in there. But as a couple, we should be there to support each other, to develop each other, to help each other grow in our married relationship. And it is over 30 plus years of marriage. There have been times out of necessity that I've had to be the major support of my wife, and then times she for me. So we learned a great deal about each other. We deepened our knowledge about each other. And we went from a marriage that was maybe surficial, we communicated about surface-only things, to deep communication, deep things that really affect our lives and affect how we live. It doesn't turn us into, you know, Marriage Encounter groupies, if you would, but it gives us a sense of open honesty with each other and an opportunity to love. Marriage Encounter gave me an opportunity to discover how to love my wife more deeply than I could ever imagine.
We're talking with Steve Burdick about Marriage Encounter. He and his wife are Marriage Encounter presenters. I'm Jim Corbett here at the State Fair on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. You're talking about someone's space and then, no, you can't talk about that, and then you can communicate that about that as a couple. That's pretty involved and complicated stuff. How do you handle that in a weekend?
Well, the weekend is programmed. We have a series of presentations, a series of talks, and they're presented by a team couple, a set of team couples and a priest. People wonder, well, why is there a priest there? And the priest certainly is there because as we were married, we marry each other. The church is the witness for our marriage. And Marriage Encounter used to always say that three and two are one. When the couple, the two, have the Trinity, three, together, and we're together as one, our marriage will be the best it could ever be. We can fall into ruts, we can fall into habits. Things that come up that can separate us can be things, attitudes on how to raise our children, attitudes on how we handle money, attitudes on vacations. How do we deal with elderly parents? How do we deal with aging children? How do we as a couple come together to deal with these issues? And each of us brings a lived experience into our marriage. And I'll give you one very simple but trite example. For a long time, we have a cultural difference on how to decorate a Christmas tree. My wife was raised in a Hispanic culture, and so she wanted to always have things that were important from her childhood as part of our Christmas tree, and mine came from a different culture, and for us to come together to build a unified Christmas tree was something that each of us kind of on a very small, you know, undercurrent level, you know, we really tussled with that. And that was just a small example of how we dealt with everything. Money, finances, marriage, dealing with friends, neighbors. You know, were we going to be open? Were we going to be reserved? Were we going to be, you know, out running up and down the road?
Let people come in the house or not?
People come in the house or not, absolutely. So, and, you know, we are called as couples to be visible witnesses of Christ's love. And, you know, we can't do that when we're sitting there watching the idiot box. It just doesn't happen.
Marriage Encounter is a topic here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. We're at the State Fair. I'm Jim Corbett, along with Steve Burdick, who, along with his wife,
Nydia,
are Marriage Encounter's presenters. And they're talking us all into either going or talking someone else into going to a marriage encounter. Final question. What really is needed for somebody to go to a marriage encounter? And as part of that, some people think it won't make a difference in their marriage. Address those two things.
What is needed to go to make a marriage encounter weekend is very simple. It is the willingness to go and the willingness to be open.
Do you have to admit you have a bad marriage?
Well, Marriage Encounter generally wants people who generally have a good marriage. There are other expressions for people who have serious complications that the church provides. One is called Retrovi. And we, as a registration couple, would, as we speak to someone, we might find out and say that, oh, you may consider this. So
it's not for terrible marriages, not for perfect marriages, it's for
marriages that want to last. And I know of no couple that had ever gone into a marriage that wanted it to fail when they stood there and professed their vows to each other. So somewhere from that step forward, they had that intent. And that's what Marriage Encounter is about.
How can you get in touch with someone to find out about Marriage Encounter?
Website, www.mes.com. And that's numeral 4, so it's www.mes4.org. And you'll find everything you can find about Marriage Encounter in South Carolina. We have two weekends coming up, February 25th through 27th at Myrtle Beach, that's 2011, and then June 10th through 12th here in Columbia, again 2011.
And you can call your own parish, and they'll have a number.
That's exactly right. They'll have numbers, brochures, and everything else. It's on the diocesan website. You can find links. So,
happily married Steve Burdick. I guess Marriage Encounter is part of the reason why you're still happily married.
Absolutely. And we work at our marriage. And we work at it every day. and that's what it takes.
Thanks for being here with Catholic Radio in South Carolina talking about Marriage Encounter.
Thank you so much.
We're at the State Fair here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina, along with Steve Burdick. I'm Jim Corbett. Steve is an assistant scoutmaster at a scout troop here in Columbia. He has spent 20 years as a scoutmaster. He is what you'd call a lifelong scout, even though he may have taken a few years off. And we're talking about scouting in South Carolina, and especially the Catholic Church and the church backing in South Carolina for scouts. What is the reason why the Catholic churches, the other Protestant denominations, will get behind and get involved in scouting?
The scouting program itself is so much in support of values that are timeless. They are values that every Christian, every civic denomination supports and upholds.
And a lot of the troops are based at churches.
A great many are based at churches, that's correct.
So scouting is a value-based organization, and it's also achievement-oriented. My son is now 7, and he is starting his scouting career in the Wolf Scouts, and he is learning to achieve and be recognized.
That's correct.
What's the scouting program? If you had to sit down and say, okay, here is our mission statement, and here is what we want a scout to experience from the first time they start until they reach Eagle Scout or high school and they no longer are involved, what is it?
Well, from the scout perspective, we want the scout to have fun constantly, to challenge themselves, to learn new skills, and to have a guiding adventure in their lives. If I were to tell the boy that you will learn morals, you will learn ethics, you will have your life patterned to a great degree, they would not be interested in that. But when we say that we go whitewater rafting, we go canoeing, we go camping in the mountains, we go out west to high adventure, we can go swimming and do those things that really appeal to a youth, those are the great things that every young man certainly dreams of. They dream of going out and seeing the world in a sense, conquering it, knowing themselves. And the scouting program is very good at helping the youth to cope in any situation at any day, any time.
This is by no means a cocoon, but the scouts do provide a protected and a protective sphere in which a young boy can learn.
Absolutely. Scouting, the training for adult leaders, the guidance training for adult leaders is unbelievable in its depth, in its scope. Everything is safety-related, safety-oriented. Every task, every skill, every accomplishment has a safety plan that the adults fill out, make sure that these things are all done properly. The scouting program is one of the best-run programs, best-administered programs, and has the best support for a program administration that you could ever hope to find.
And it's not just physical safety, but it's emotional safety, able to grow and to communicate with adults and children and older people, older boys and girls who are not yet adults.
That's correct. And it builds teamwork among youth. Instead of having youth picking on each other and creating a negative atmosphere, the scouting program guides and pushes the youth into working together as a team to accomplish goals. Now, the scouts have fun, and they don't realize that, of course, this is happening. And all they know is they're earning badges, they're advancing, they're learning skills that they can put to use in their everyday life and for their future. And they don't realize, perhaps, that they're learning these lifelong skills.
What kind of skills?
Planning for yourself, service to others, service to God and country, those are hallmark for the scouting program.
How to read a map?
Oh, of course, how to read a map, how to use a compass, and of course, it's timely now because you also learn to find your way with a global positioning satellite receiver, so they become useful in using GPS. We still teach how to find your way at night without a compass using the North Star, how to find your way during the day just by using the sun. to make a solar compass. We teach many, many techniques for adaptation in every manner of life, whether it's indoors or out of doors.
Emergency plans are the norm.
Absolutely.
For hurricanes, disasters.
Sure. Emergency preparedness is one of the required merit badges for a young man in Boy Scouts to earn. And every troop has certainly safety plans. Safety plans you can take home and put into practice. And almost every advancement, almost every merit badge has the young man taking this skill home and putting this into action in their home. We have a fire escape chart for my house. We have an energy safety, we have an energy conservation plan through one of my son's merit badges. We have rally points, we have disaster preparedness kits, first aid kits. We're fairly ready for those types of incidents. And it's more than that, but it's a training of thinking, how do I take care of myself? How do I protect myself? If I see that there's a hurricane coming, what do I do?
And who do I help, too?
Who do I help?
Because right. You have to deal with other scouts and come up with plans.
That's
kids
correct.
Are older, younger, like the same things you like, don't like the same things
That's
you like.
That's correct. And, you know, service is the other hallmark of scouting, where you take these skills and you share them with the public. At Christmas time, my son's scout troop goes Christmas caroling in retirement homes. We do service boxes for soldiers overseas. Those are just some of the few things that we do in service to the community. Every youth to really advance has to have a service element. When they finish accomplishing the service project goal, they have an inward sense of accomplishment and an inward sense of reward and an inward sense of, I've done something valuable for someone. You can't take those away. Those are things that they earned with their sweat and their handiwork.
We're speaking with Steve Burdick at the State Fair here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina. He is Assistant Scoutmaster of Troop 91 here in Columbia. And, Steve, we talked all around it about faith. Let's talk directly about it. Bishop Guglielmone is such a big supporter of scouting in South Carolina. He went to the Camporee in October. What do you teach about the faith in scouting, whether you're Catholic or a Protestant or a Jew?
You know, the bishop has been such a tremendous supporter of scouting, and I just cannot compliment him and his attitude toward assisting scouting programs enough. He has been just a dynamic spark plug, if you would. But the scouting program itself, to get into the faith end, you learn a lot of things that begin with natural law. And natural law is that base foundation from which all things really develop. Natural law of living, seen in the out of doors. Most young men find closeness with, as scouting would say, who they recognize to be, in their faith expression, to be God in the out of doors. And they always refer to it as that great chapel, that great outdoor chapel of God's creation. The scouting program has always, it has based itself on duty to God, then duty to country. I have included in the scout law that a scout should be reverent. And actually to join and to be a scout, you must have some faith belief as you can define it. And as a scouter, I'm as responsible for the development of all scouts in my troop. When I was a scout master, I met with every pastor, Protestant or Catholic. I put the program for the God and Country program in their hands. I made sure every youth had this available to them, and I would push them. I said, have you thought about your duty to God? Have you thought about working with your pastor in developing this? And it's been a great sense of pride for me that so many of the kids in my troops have earned that God and Country. The Catholic Church in scouting really kicked all this off back in the 30s with the Adultari Dei program. So the Catholic scouting really has set the example of interface with your pastor, your home church.
Timeless values, tried and true results. We're
Absolutely.
Sitting here talking to one right now, and Steve Burdick, a former scout, now an assistant scoutmaster, former scoutmaster. And all the Boy Scouts out there listening can attest to the fact that this was a great experience based on faith. Steve Burdick, thank you very much for being with us here on Catholic Radio in South Carolina, here at the State Fair to talk about scouting, particularly scouting among Catholics, and I know Bishop Guglielmone is glad that you're involved.
Thank you.
This concludes our special presentation, Catholic Radio at the Fair. We now rejoin our regular EWTN programming already in progress.